I've just put together a few ideas, really. I don't know if many people are familiar with March Pierce, or Woman on the Edge of Town. I've written down a few ideas. They're heavily plagiarised, you may notice. I haven't had a chance to properly sort them out. But just see what you think about some of this. It's kind of following on a little bit from our discussion about women members in the party and potentially attracting women and maybe why they don't get involved. So I wanted to briefly introduce the work of March Pierce, in particular her novel, Woman on the Edge of Town. I want to do this in the context of acknowledging the personal political power of reading fiction and how reading is gendered. So why talk about literature? I've always loved reading novels. I went to study literature twice at university, taking from it a great deal of inspiration, comfort, community and personal growth. As a much younger woman, who at the time considered herself an anarcho-feminist and was also exploring her sexuality, I sought out novels which related to relationships different from the mainstream. I read novels with a lot of sex and politics coming across among many genres, for example, lesbian feminist fiction with titles such as Murder in the Cooperative, for example, a book which explored dealing with conflict within what transpired to be a superficially non-hierarchical community. So, I saw the process of reading as an active one, and I believe that we seek out fiction which speaks about issues we are facing in our lives at the time. It's always struck me that the number of women studying literature and the number reading fiction far outnumbers men. In fact, surveys show that women account for 80% of sales in the UK, US and Canadian fiction markets. Far more women than men are literary festival goers, library members, audio book readers, literary bloggers and members of literary societies and evening classes. It is also, for the most part, women who teach children to read, both at school and at home, and women who form book clubs, often actively shutting out men. Ian McEwan once wrote, "When women stop reading, the novel will be dead." Back in 2005, he and his son, emptying the library of his London house, took stacks of books to a local park to give away. He said every woman he approached asked for three, whereas every man frowned in suspicion or distaste and usually said something like, "Nah, nah, not for me. Thanks, mate, but no." Helen Taylor has recently written a book called Why Women Read Fiction, The Stories of Our Lives. She observes that men are quick to state their reasons for reading as having solid use, such as an historical novel teaching them about the past, or that they are using fiction for research purposes. There is a strong suggestion that women read books to understand themselves and men to escape themselves. Taylor says that it is rare to find men expressing the ways in which reading has impacted on their emotional, spiritual and sexual lives. And when men do read fiction, they don't tend to read fiction by women, which Taylor claims that women, Taylor claims that women read and admire male novelists, rarely making value judgments. So March Pierce, who is March Pierce? March Pierce is a novelist who's published more than 17 volumes of poems, 15 novels, a play and a collection of essays. All of her books share a focus on women's lives. Wikipedia, maybe questionable source, but maybe, describes her as a feminist, environmentalist, Marxist and anti-war activist who was involved in the civil rights movement, New Left and Students for Democratic Society. Pierce developed her love of books when she came down with German measles in her mid-childhood and could do little but read. She said, "It taught me that there's a different world there, that there were all these horizons that were quite different from what I could see." She says of her book, Woman on the Edge of Time, that like most women's utopias, it is profoundly anarchist. So briefly, because I'm not going to really follow much of that, I'll tell you the brief plot of Woman on the Edge of Time. It was written in the 1970s, and it's in the 1970s, Connie, an impoverished and alienated woman, oppressed also because of her sex and her Mexican heritage, is signed into a psychiatric unit by her nurse's pimp, who she punches in an effort to protect her. She is visited from someone from the future, and the novel contrasts the world she inhabits now with this potentially future society called Matapoisa. I'm not sure if that's right. The society is largely based upon the common ownership and democratic control of the means and instruments for producing and distributing wealth by and in the interest of the whole community. Where that's from. It looks at different ways work is organized now. Now, once the work done is only that which is useful, addressing questions such as who does the dirty work and what happens if someone won't work. It looks at the management and restoration of the environment, the making of decisions. People spend a lot of time in meetings. The different means of raising children and having sexual and friendship relationships in a world where hierarchies and powers and power relationships are no more. The novel, in my opinion, this novel in particular, is an example of how fictional literature, like music or paintings, can have the power to challenge and advocate change in perhaps the same way more obviously factual literature can, like the socialist standard, advocate change. So, I'm just to finish off, I'm going to read you the author's introduction to The Woman on the Edge of Time in 2016, which was written 40 years after she first wrote it. This gives you a bit of an idea into what she was trying to do. Why write a novel like Woman on the Edge of Time set in the future? The point of writing about the future is not to predict it. I'm not pretending to be Nostradamus. The point of such writing is to influence the present by extrapolating current trends for advancement or detriment. The point of creating futures is to get people to imagine what they want and don't want to happen down the road and maybe do something about it. Woman on the Edge of Time was first published 40 years ago and begun 3.5 years before that. The early 1970s was a time of great political ferment and optimism among those of us who longed for change, for a more just and egalitarian society, with more opportunities for all the people, not just some of them. Since then, inequality has greatly increased. As I write this, more people are poor, more people are working two or three jobs just to get by, more people find that their savings and their future have been wiped out by bad health or losing their jobs. The homeless are everywhere. Not just the single man or woman down on their luck or the shuffling bag lady, but whole families with their children. There is less opportunity for the children of ordinary people to afford college. If they can go, they will be dragging huge debt through most of their adult lives. Many jobs that paid enough to buy and pay off a house, to hope for an even better life for their children, have been shipped overseas, where poorer people, even poorer than those are losing their jobs, will do them for pennies. Unions that protected workers have lots more, much, much less of a clout and represent fewer workers each year. At the time I wrote this novel, women were making huge gains in control of their bodies and their lives. Not only has that momentum been lost, but many of the rights we worked so hard to secure have been taken from us. I wanted the novel to show an ecologically sound society. The lives and institutions and rituals of the society all stress being part of a nature and responsible for natural world. In imagining the good society, I borrowed from all the progressive movements of that time. Like most women's utopias, Woman on the Edge of Time is profoundly anarchist and aimed at integrating people back into the natural world and eliminating power relationships. The nuclear family is rare in feminist utopias and banished from this novel. Instead of slut-shaming, I promised a society in which sex was available, accepted and non-hierarchical and totally divorced from income, social status, power. No trophy wives, no closeting, no punishment for preferring one kind of lover to another. No need to sell or buy sex. Not being stuck like my own mother in a loveless marriage because she had no way to support herself. I was brought in. Oh, she talks about being brought in undercover into psychiatric wards at the time to understand what was going on. She says people risk their jobs to help me. Now mental health patients are dumped on the streets without support. We still drug, but we provide little counselling or safe and comfortable lodging. There's no improvement. I'm always interested in who controls technology in any given society at a particular time. Who decides that trolleys and passenger trains are obsolete, but that cars are all important and our cities must be built around them as if they were the primary inhabitants? Who chooses which technology is explored? Who sets the rules for what is dangerous and what is acceptable? Who decides what is done and whom it is done to? How are decisions made in a fair and equalitarian way was one of the main themes of the novel. I'm also very interested in the socializing and interpersonal mechanisms of a society. How is conflict dealt with? Again, who gets to decide and upon whose head and back are these decisions visited? How does the society deal with loneliness and alienation? How does it deal with getting born, growing up and learning, having sex, making babies, becoming sick and healing, dying and being disposed of? How do we deal with our collective memories, our history that we're constantly reshaping? Utopia is born of the hunger for something better, but it relies on hope as the engine for imagining such a future. My desire to take what I considered the most fruitful ideas of the various movements for social change and make them vivid and concrete was the genesis of Woman on the Edge of Time. That's me.
Okay, you done? Well,
yeah, sorry.
Oh, right, okay. Thank you. Oh, that was interesting. I remember we were talking about this the other day, and you said something about how Miles Piercy was saying that there were certain aspects of the novel that she wouldn't lay special emphasis on today, to borrow Marx and Engels' phrase about the Communist Manifesto.
Yeah.
Well, I remember the thing about the men having a womb implant so that they could have babies and be exactly the same as the women. Thinking at the time that was a bit silly.
Yes, she did say about that, actually. She did sort of say that she was not going to, she was going to make different options available, but that got lost somehow. Yeah, she said if she was going to change anything, she'd change that.
Yeah, because there was a kind of, there was a theme of asexuality, wasn't there? Or if that's not even the right word, is it agenderism? Have I just made that up? Basically, the women and the men were just indistinguishable, androgynous in the story, weren't they?
Yeah,
that's the word I'm looking for. Was that a particular feature of 70s feminism, or was that just kind of her idea at the time?
I think there was a notion as well that when work was divided differently, you know, and that women would be doing more physical labour, that bodies would change as well, and nutritionally bodies would change. But yeah, I think there was that notion of kind of trying to get rid of gender altogether.
Was that a bit of a 70s feminist trope, though? I mean, I can't remember it being, but
some elements.
Maybe a more sort of radical feminist idea, maybe.
I think among some people. I can't quite remember about The Dispossessed. Has anybody read that?
Yeah, I have.
Is that a theme in there as well?
I can't remember.
Hiya, Lorna. Yeah, it's quite interesting. I was actually reading Woman at the Edge of Time when I went out to Greece with Dave Barber, and I had my schizophrenic episode or whatever. And I ended up in a psyche ward about 3 or 4 weeks later after I got back from holiday. And because I was reading Women at the Edge of Time, I thought there was two-way mirrors and they were bugging me. And, you know, I was very ill, really. You know. But Women at the Edge of Time had her in a psyche ward being taken into the future. And, you know, I think it was the wrong book at the wrong time for me, really, you know. But, I mean, I'll probably get it again and reread it now that I'm not ill, really, you know. But it caused a bit of paranoia in me because of the way they described the psyche ward in the book, really.
Yeah, I can understand that. What's anybody's view about men and women reading differently and perhaps... Perhaps there's a way that we can kind of put things in the standard that are a little bit more. I mean, I know we've talked about things that are appealing to women, but maybe like if we did more fictional type stuff. I don't know. It's just an idea.
Yeah, I think that's quite a good idea. I mean, there have been short stories published in the past in the Standard, but speaking as one of the editors, I can say that nobody ever submits a story. I think people have got this kind of idea that, oh, the Standard is a certain thing and therefore and you have to write articles in a certain accepted way and it never publishes articles, therefore it never publishes stories, therefore it doesn't want stories and that sort of thing. So I think there may be a bit of self-editing going on, or maybe there's just writers in the party don't want to write stories. I don't know.
And what do you think about this notion that fiction can be a quite strong political tool? I'm thinking about things like Ragged Trousers Philanthropist as well.
Well, I remember once a summer school putting the argument that popular culture, in particular film and TV, themes that you find in film and TV, was a strong indicator stroke driver of political change. But that was quite heavily opposed by a lot of members there who just said, yeah, this is just made up stories. It doesn't mean anything. It's just irrelevant escapism. And I always thought, no, I don't know. I think there's a lot more to it than that. I think we feed our culture into our stories, and our stories feed back into our culture in a kind of, you know, in a sort of dynamic process. So I do think that absolutely that fiction has a role to play in the sort of political zeitgeist.
And it's very interesting, isn't it, that, you know, if we think about a criticism being that, you know, it's that fiction is escapism, and escapism is associated, it's a bit of a guilty pleasure, something that's not really worthwhile, something that, you know, and if we think that then there that you know, that reading is very gendered and that we're a lot more women than men read, then you can kind of see you can see the parallel between that and women just being generally undervalued in society and seen as a bit sort of silly and, you know, not very serious, not very full of substance. Do you get what I'm saying? Sorry, that wasn't expressed very clearly.
I think also cinema and things like that, really, you know, and television, you know, I mean, it's all used for propaganda, for capitalism, a lot of it. But some of it isn't, you know, some of it's actually talking and criticising and things. And you do have a few directors in cinema, you know, Mike Lee and people like that, you know, that actually put forward criticisms of the society and things. And books can do that as well, you know, fiction can do that. And I think it's very important. I mean, if you read anything about the French writer Simone de Beauvoir, she used to go to the cinema with Jean-Paul Sartre and do a sort of criticism of the film or whatever in terms of its ideology or whatever, you know. So it'd be interesting to see that. And if you look at daily papers, a lot of women read the Daily Mail, and it's because they write articles that appeal to women, really, you know. So I know that, you know, the Daily Mail's pro-capitalist to the bone, really, you know. But I mean, we can learn from the good literature and the good stories and the good films that actually talk about criticizing society and talk about something better, really, you know. And I think it's important that we can do that through culture.
One thing I never really understood about Woman on the Edge of Time was why she used the setting of a mental hospital in the first place. Because I just thought, doesn't this allow people to dismiss the story of the future anarchist society by just saying, oh, well, she's just mad, isn't she? She's just imagined it all. It's not real. It's just a made-up utopia. Didn't that rather undermine the point of the novel? I never quite got it myself.
I think in lots of ways she was critiquing the mainstream notion of what madness is and mental ill health is. Rather than, you know, people sometimes, because in Woman on the Edge of Time, there are times when people have moments of so-called madness and they go off and they explore themselves, and it's seen as just a part of development, something that sometimes happens, rather than something that's taboo and that should be a bad thing. So, yeah, I get what you're saying, but on the other end, you could argue, no, in fact, it was really crucial to a novel in terms of criticising the medical institution, among others.
Well, that was what I thought was the problem, really, is that the book almost in a way didn't quite know what it was about. you know, if she wanted to write a critique of the medical establishment, maybe she should have just done that. But if she wanted to put a, you know, write about an anarchist society, maybe she should have just done that. But she was trying to do too much in one story. And I think, arguably, maybe fell between two stools a little bit.
I confess I hadn't even come across Margie Pierce, and so obviously not read anything, but I shall be doing, because it's, you know, from what you're all saying here, it sounds very, very interesting. And especially because, Lorna, you read what she wrote in, I think you said 2014, something like 40 years after she'd written the novel. It really does make me want to go and find out more about it. Sounds extremely interesting. I can't really talk about that, you know, because I haven't got the background for it. I'm interested in this about women apparently read more novels than men. I'm sort of surprised. That must be because just my own personal experience with the people close to me, the men who have been close to me and are close to me, continue to be, I'm sure they read as many novels as I do. We swap novels and we talk about them and say, have you read so-and-so? Do you know so-and-so? And I can't, on a personal level, haven't noticed men don't read them. But I have seen on the surface level, in other areas, is that unfortunately I don't know why this is, what it's to do with them, who I know or what have you. But some of the women I have known have read what I would consider sort of a trash. Sorry about that. A couple of those are relations as well, by the way. What am I trying to say? I don't know, really. I'm just trying to join in. But it's certainly a stimulating topic here.
I suspect there's a class aspect to this. If you go into a lot of so-called working class houses, you'll often see not a single book anywhere in the house. You might see a massive 50-inch TV screen, but no book. If you go into a quote-unquote middle-class house, you know, college, university backgrounds, you'll see shelves of books. It doesn't matter what the sex of the person is that lives there. You'll just see that. So I think as you sort of go up the kind of class rankings of the working class up towards the sort of educated, the prosperous middle class, you'll see more book reading. But I think where the difference probably is, and you'd need to see a more of a demographic breakdown to you know, prove this, but I think probably where you see the disparity most is at the bottom end, where you know, men just don't read books, and women are reading these in a lot of cases kind of romances and Mills and Boone and the kind of a lot of the kind of trashy stuff that you were talking about, Janet.
Yeah, interesting. You see, I'm definitely from a working class family. My dad was a blast furnace worker. We did have books in the house, not a lot, but what we did have was we were avid library people. The three sisters, mum and dad, both went to the library, both read a lot. My father died 20 years ago now. He was very old. But he never stopped reading, ever. He was always extraordinarily curious about everything. My mother also, although she didn't have so much time to read, you know why, she died more than 50 years ago, but she also was a reader of classic novels and not trash for her at all. I understand what you're saying. It's not, that's just personal stuff, isn't it? So where am I going with it? Don't know yet.
Yeah, I mean, I was brought up in a working class family. My dad worked for ICI, my mum worked in a cannery and things. I mean, didn't have many books in the house, but I mean, I got into books at quite an early age. And I used to get joined book clubs and order all the Russian books or whatever, you know, Dostoevsky and people like that. My dad never read any books, but my mum was an avid reader, but she liked crime books, really, you know, and she used a library, really, you know. So we didn't have loads of bookshelves on the shelf. The only books we had were the ones I ordered. My dad never really read any books, really, you know. But, I mean, I don't know if we were typical. I mean, I've got friends. I've been in some friends' houses where there's no books at all. I won't name them, really, you know. And I've been in other friends' houses where there's masses of books, really, you know, on the shelves or whatever. So I don't know. Yeah.
It's really interesting about people reading novels and literature, because I can honestly say that that definitely I know more women who read more fiction than men, and unfortunately actually it's annoyed me over the years a little bit.
Party members have often, I think, traditionally come from that sort of great sort of working class staple, the autodidact, you know, the sort of self-taught. My mum was definitely one of those, very working class, but read voraciously, mostly science fiction. So I got into the habit of reading science fiction as well. And I think, I wonder, you know, in today's culture, what's happened to the working class autodidact? A lot of kids now are learning a lot of stuff from YouTube, which has some amazing stuff on it, stuff that people put up. Yesterday I was watching the history of the world from 10,000, you know, 100,000 BC to the modern day in about 15 minutes, marking in all the migrations, all the invasions, all the empires flashing past you at lightning speed. Quite amazing things that people have access to, young people are watching these things and learning stuff that in a new way, not through reading books, but in a kind of bite-sized way. I don't know if that's better or worse. It's just different.
Interesting, isn't it? Because I wonder, as fewer and fewer children seem to read and spend a lot of time gathering knowledge through the internet, what will become of the novel?
Just want to add, it's totally non, very low brow, I think. I collect books, old books, because I love the smell of them. I can't imagine the internet ever giving me that. I know that's.
But you do read them as well.
I do read them, but I often go into where we have our books, and I pick one off the shelf, and I just smell it. I just love it. I love the smell of an old book.
There's probably a Greek word for that ending in philia.
I'd like to learn it, Paddy. I like to know these things.
Well, I'm a devotee of Kindle books, somewhat to my own surprise, mainly because you can prop them up on the breakfast table and read them without the book folding up and falling in your fried egg.
Trouble with the Kindle is, of course, you can't mark it. I can't work out how I've given mine away because I like to, it depends what the book is. No, I don't think with novels I do it. With the factual things, I'm writing bits all over the place and want to be able to flick through and get back to it. Again, that's a personal thing, isn't it?
Oh, you can actually mark them and make notes and mark bits of text.
I'm useless at the technology, you know.
She can't anymore, Paddy. She's given it away. She couldn't handle it.
Yeah, that's right. I've given it to someone who's appreciating it.
Because I write all over my novels, but I never do it on the Kindle.
Go back a bit, Lorne. I've just remembered something you said about the, if I can grasp my thought, about why people would, or is it men? We're asking why people want to read something that isn't factual. And what I find really useful about novels, never mind about the enjoyment side of it, but what useful is the things that you can learn just incidentally. It's probably nothing to do with the theme of the book. Something is touched on. It can be a historical fact, geographical fact. Like, for instance, I'm reading something now which is about based in based around the Indian immigrant areas at the time of the Mau Mau. So you've got the British there, the Indians, and ones who were born there and lived there for centuries, the Africans. But what the novel is about is that going through a lifetime, but there are so many little nuances in it to really help you put together the whole thing of what was happening there at the time. It somehow gives rather than a factual book, rather than reading a history book, it gives you the emotions and that side of story, which really rings for me. I'm sure it does for an awful lot of people. It gives it a much fuller context.
I wonder if what you read or whether you read depends on the sorts of things that you are in the habit of thinking about and talking about to other people. So it seems to me anecdotally obvious that men tend to talk about things that are outside of themselves, things out there in the world that are unrelated to their own personal state of mind, their feelings, their relationships, all of that sort of thing, things out there in the world, external things. And so nonfiction feeds that particular interest. And whereas with women, again, anecdotally, I'm sure there are exceptions, but I tend to be more interested in, or more focused on feelings and emotions and stuff. And so that kind of informs their particular choice of reading, which would be novels in that case. Does that sound reasonable?
I think so, definitely anecdotally. I think there's something to also to be said, just expanding on that, and people looking in literature for a sense of community. You know, particularly people who may be alienated from the community that they're in, so they may seek out and read, for example, I don't know, like I've used before, like lesbian fiction. Or I certainly sought out books which explore political ideas, like, you know, anarchism and the notion of utopias and technology and things like that. So yes, I would say so. I would say maybe like women read more. And I think this is one of the things that Taylor has said in her book about why women read fiction. Women look more for a sense of connectedness and to understand themselves and to understand the people around them, whereas potentially men look more externally. And in that way, turning on its head, they're using literature to escape. As escapism from internal turmoils or difficulties or just their internal selves, and women are more using it more as a form of connection, perhaps.
Well, going on from that point, then, if we could sort of agree for the sake of argument that men are by and large more interested in, as it were, the world out there that's external to themselves, where does that leave the Socialist Party and its concern with the world out there exclusively? Does that mean that there's a sort of something about the way we do politics in the Socialist Party that is intrinsically male biased because of the way that men tend to think and the way that women tend to think? Could that be so?
And if you look at a book like Women on the Edge of Time, which very much has a similar sort of perspective as our party does, you will see that running through it is a strong emphasis on the way that people relate to one another. Now, I think we, although obviously relationships are a part of what we talk about in the party, somehow sometimes the way we discuss a future society or the society we live in is less personal. And in fact, I've heard, you know, the old slogan, the personal is political, feminist idea, I've heard it hugely dismissed in the party as being somehow reformist and about identity politics. Now, for me, the personal is political meant that every aspect of our lives, how we feel, how we relate, how we eat, how we family is political.
Now, I wonder if we could argue then that maybe there's a how we arrive at our politics is or how men and women arrive at politics is through a different route. So women come to politics through a study of their relationships, but men come to their politics perhaps in spite of their relationships or by circumventing their personal life.
I mean, just in a small way, that's interesting, because that leads on from the discussion we were having the other day about how many women were involved in the party as with their male partners, and how often when the relationship broke up, it was the women that left, not the men. Now, I'm not saying by any means in any way that, you know, that women come to the party because they're led by men. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is that definitely sort of relationships are considered within that. So, I think in looking at the way that I related to other people, in understanding power relationships, sort of through an understanding of maybe domestic abuse, or you know, relationships within the family where roles were very gendered, that was part and parcel of me widening my politics up to look at sort of the whole notions of non-hierarchical society in general. And eventually led me through the route of also things like punk music had a huge influence on me. But that they kind of like led me down the route eventually to come to the party.
Yeah, it seems really curious to me that we must have noticed about our own party that its approach to politics, at least in its published literature, is quite cerebral. It's quite, you know, we say that we're scientific socialists and we try and set about the task of putting the case in a kind of logical, rational, scientific way. Socialist standard articles, you know, we have a policy generally that's generally adhered to where the writer doesn't include themselves as part of their argument. This is a very academic practice. We see this is the correct way to put our arguments. I'm just wondering if there's something about all of this that's intrinsically kind of male in approach. And we're not doing it because we're on purpose. We just don't know how else to be. That's the men.
That's really interesting, Paddy, that you say that you don't include yourself. Don't you not talk from a sort of my perspective? Or because you know that when I did women's studies years ago, it was a real thing about reclaiming your voice and speaking from your own position and using your own personal experience. You talk about it as your experience alongside academic research. I do think so. I don't think that there's anything to be won in depersonalizing anything, and certainly within feminist academia, that wouldn't be the case. You would not be put down or seen as your work wouldn't have been seen as any less if you were to in fact you would be often you work gained marks in a sense from stating your standpoint first and foremost, because there is no such thing as absolute objectivity. We all go to our work from our own position.
The question of here is, you said a little earlier, Paddy, about some of the standard in previous years. It's that we get up socially standard past and present from Dowell in the US, isn't it? He puts up. And he actually does sort of shuffle things about quite a lot through the years. And there've obviously been quite a lot of individuals who've written stories, if you like, maybe not their own personal stories, but actually done it as fiction. And for me, it's very good. I like to see some kind of balance there. It really is, although probably, I come to think of it, all those ones have probably been written by men anyway. Just going through my head for the authors. That doesn't matter. It's what they're writing about that matters, of course. It would be great, but probably the problem is as well, is you have to wait for submissions. Who's going to submit? You actually, are there enough people to go to and say, hey, you know, we could do with a bit of fiction here. Does that come into it as well?
Well, I think the general, I think probably the fear of the editors on this score is that it would be better not to have any poems and short stories in the standard than have bad poems and bad short stories in the standard. They would do us far more damage than if we just don't have them in the first place. And writers can be generally relied on to do an okay article on a political subject of the day. But when it comes to doing good fiction and good poetry, that's a tall order. It's much harder to do that. And so I think that, yes, generally the standard steers clear of that whole area, even to the extent that if a poem was received that was, you know, halfway decent, there would be a fear that, oh dear, now we're going to be opening the floodgates to an awful lot of, you know, bad stuff, an awful lot of doggerel that we then wouldn't be able to say no to. So it's that's a risky path to go down, I think. And also there's a sense in which I think that the party's remit is to take on capitalism at the world level, and we've got to feel like we're being taken seriously in the world political arena. And I think there's probably a fear that being too touchy-feely means we wouldn't be taken seriously. And I'm suggesting that. I don't know that for a fact. I've never had a discussion like this with Social Standard editors or anybody else, but I wonder if that's the case. And whether this fear of not being taken seriously lies at the back of this practice of this impersonal academic style, which now looking at it, I'm beginning to think, I wonder if we're losing more than we're gaining.
Yeah, I would say it's not about touchy-feely. It's about someone getting a message across, and some of the fictional stuff that I've seen from, over the decades, there's been some very interesting submissions. I'm not suggesting that it should be made something which would be in every standard at all. But it's also that thing, if people aren't offering them anyway, don't have a choice also. And, you know, the people who write the academic political stuff, you can't expect them to be writing fictional stuff anyway, I don't think. It's probably quite a divisive, or quite a division in people's the way we talk about stuff, write about stuff. It's not that I'm recommending it. I just, it's great to see just the message come through in as many different ways as possible. That was my point.
Just returning to the subject under discussion, Marge Piercy, I've been quite surprised, actually, how many party members I've talked to who don't know this book. And when I was first in the party, it was sort of thrust at me as this kind of must read. You know, it's one of the socialist, you know, go-to books. The two others would be William Morris' News from Nowhere and Ursula Le Guin's Dispossessed, which we will probably do in a subsequent Sunday session. And it would struck me that these are the three socialist classics, two of which describe themselves as anarchist, incidentally. And out of the three, two were written by women. That does seem to me, I don't know what significance I would read into that, but there certainly must be something there.
What about a book list, a recommended reading list? I haven't seen such a thing. Anybody thought about coming up with that?
Yeah, there have been book lists.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, there have been book lists in the past. I can remember this subject coming out some years ago when, you know, by email discussion on Spincom or something. And, yeah, people had all sorts of suggestions of better or worse quality. But those are the three standout ones. Nothing else really comes close.
Sorry,
go on.
Maybe it's something we can put on our web page. You know, our standard, socialist standard web page, a list of suggested novels.